to Sight.
Spend the day with Sight.
From 6 a.m. to 9:30 p.m.
on Radio Sight Thursday Live.
Radio Sight Thursday Live.
Stay tuned.
Welcome, dear listeners, to this Thursday's afternoon satsang, where we will be continuing with Conversations with Sai. The last week, we had a very interesting discussion, because in the interview room, when Bhagwan and Hislop are conversing, there was the presence of the students as well. One particular student from Hong Kong, and the conversation slowly became between these three. And Swami was encouraging Hislop to ask questions from this student about his philosophy of life, his view of life, especially with his conviction towards Swami. And from that, from the answers that the student gives, we don't know for sure whether these are coming from experience or conviction or simply from knowing what Swami likes, but from wherever they are coming, either it's coming from experience or conviction or from even just knowing that Swami likes this, it is indeed commendable, because these are all different stages of the same journey. Today we shall actually continue along the same conversation, because along with the student, later on in the conversation, many more students also get pulled in, and some very, very interesting things, day-to-day practical things, problems that most of us face, especially as youngsters or young adults, all of that gets covered, and I'm sure it'll be very, very, very interesting. I'm eagerly looking forward to it, and I'm sure so is Prem, whom I will welcome to the show now, Sairam Prem, and together we offer our humble pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet, and Sairam to all of you.
Sairam Arvind and Sairam to all our listeners. Just a little correction in probably what you said, because we did mention it last time also. These conversations are specifically not happening in the interview room as such, but in the old bungalow where, you know, Swami's students are standing around in the garden in various places as they generally do. So this is a conversation with some of those boys Swami's randomly calling and having. And as you rightly mentioned, one of them is a student who's come from Hong Kong, and specifically I think somewhere I mentioned, I don't know if we've come past that place, where Swami says that he is about to give a talk the next day or something.
Yes, we covered that also.
Right, and that's how the conversation begins. So Swami tells Hislop that this boy is going to be speaking tomorrow and ask him some questions if you want. And that's how the conversation is happening, but it's very interesting, and that's what we had mentioned even the last time. The opportunity of getting a peek into what Swami has in his mind for the educational institutions, and, you know, the way Swami wanted the students to be groomed, all of that, an insight into that can be seen through some of these conversations. As you said, we cannot completely claim that these are experience-based answers that these boys are giving, but, you know, probably the starting point is to know the right answers, even if you have not reeling out the answers out of experience. And that's what we're seeing. And we've seen this trend continue even to the later years, when Swami would randomly call primary school students and ask them, you know, where do you come from? And they would say, we're coming from Swami's lotus feet. And things like that, which probably at that age, there's no way a student might, you know, experientially know or intellectually even understand. But Swami would appreciate that and kind of also encourage that kind of training of such children, because it goes a long way. Like I was witnessing you know, one of the Balvikas dramas which are put in Swami's presence. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a discourse where Swami speaks about the idea of enacting dramas in Swami's presence or elsewhere, because it's a very important component of Balvikas training itself.
Mm-hmm.
Where Swami says, when these dramas are enacted, you know, we look at it from the point of view of how good the quality of the presentation was and how's the dialogue and how did they really act. Swami would say, all that doesn't matter. When those children participate in an event like a drama, whatever has been taught in a classroom, it's an opportunity for them to briefly live that or speak that. And later in life, it will come to them that, you know, a very similar simulation was done in the form of a drama, and that will come to their memory. And this is precisely what Swami is doing even in the form of these conversations also, I think.
I remember a Chinnakatha that Swami had narrated. There is this thief who burgles a house at night, but when he is trying to go out, there is some alarm that is raised and all the people in the village rise up and they start coming out, the lights are switched on. So this thief is now desperate, he doesn't know how to escape. He gets an idea. He takes the bundle in which all his stolen stuff is there and he hides it into the hollow of a tree. Under that same tree, you know, he quickly sheds his upper garments, takes some dust and applies it like vibhuti over his chest and hands, and he sits in meditation. His hope is that people will mistake him for a sannyasi or a sage or a saint who is meditating and just let him go. And that is precisely what happens. He's very thrilled when people come to him and ask him whether, oh, revered sir, did you see a person running away with valuables in this direction or something like that, which makes it very, very clear to him that they don't suspect him to be the thief. Now, while he is celebrating the fact that he fooled all the villagers, he suddenly realizes the new predicament that he is in, because now many of the villagers start sitting near him and start, you know, worshipping him. They are very honored to have a revered sage in their midst, in their village. And this is something that the thief never expected nor has experienced before. But he has no choice. He sits and continues to act. He continues to act, and the adoration and worship from the villagers never seem to cease only, because throughout the day there is somebody and there are people who say, come to our house, take rest. And it so happens for weeks together, this person starts leading the life of a sannyasi, enforced upon him. It is enforced upon him, but he keeps begging, he keeps collecting the food, he keeps staying there because the villagers are not letting him out of their sight. All the while his eye is definitely on that bag of valuables that he has hidden in the hollow of the tree. But as days turn to weeks, turn to months, suddenly he realizes that, you know what, just pretending to be a sannyasi itself, I am able to see how much respect, love and, you know, regards and everything I'm getting. All this is something that I had to struggle for, strive for, and try to steal it. By just being a, in quotes, false sannyasi itself, I'm getting all this. Why do I need to go back to that kind of a life? He, in fact, has a change of heart. He lets go of all those valuables. He, in fact, becomes a true sannyasi. And Swami says that when you come onto the good path, sometimes you may just pretend to be good, but it's fine. You pretend to be good, then you will tend to be good, and you will end being good. I think it's in that spirit that it helps when you say people act in dramas, people do these, or even to that matter, when we say about Swami talking to students and student giving answers. There was this primary school boy, you know, Swami comes to him and asks him, where do you come from? And he says, Swami, from your lotus feet. Swami is so happy. And the senior students on the side, sitting and watching this interaction, they feel that this is the perfect answer to give Swami. So when Swami comes to them and asks, where do you come from? This boy, senior boy, gets up and says, Swami, from your lotus feet. Swami says, hey, where do you come from? He says, Swami, from your lotus feet. Hey, don't do all this, you know, jhuta philosophy, Swami would say. Tell me where you come from. And the moment Swami tells it sternly, this boy says, Swami, I'm from Delhi, or I'm from Bombay, or whatever it is. So it is very evident that it was not the experience or conviction, but it is pretension. But why is it that Swami appreciates the pretension of the primary school boy and not of the college boy? Because you know what, I have seen on an occasion where Swami does this stern kind of interaction with the primary school boy as well. When he says, I am from your lotus feet, Swami says, no, tell where you are from. Swami, from your lotus feet. Tell me where you are from. Swami, from your lotus feet. Hey, tell me where you come from. This boy is now trembling with fear. He's scared. And yet, with a trembling voice, he says, Swami, from your lotus feet. You know, so that is one level of conviction that this boy, though he may not have experienced it or though he may not understand it, he's very sincere in saying it. Because even when he's threatened, he still says, Swami, I'm from your lotus feet. This is probably the reason why the primary school boys from your lotus feet is appreciated, whereas the university boys from your lotus feet is not appreciated. It's all different levels of sincerity and experience and conviction. So though there is no experience, there is conviction in the primary school boy. So therefore, all this I'm saying is to bring us back to the fact that it all has a small beginning. It begins even with something as frivolous as pretension. But once we start pretending to be good, we start acting to be good. In a drama, that's what happens. I act nobility, I act goodness. But somewhere it rubs off, and in times to come, it becomes part of my nature. And that is what Swami has come to foster. And that is the reason why, even in his presence, Swami allowed us to speak lofty things, speak spiritual truths, though we might not have experienced them, though we might not even be regularly practicing them. The idea was to encourage us so that even as we pretend, one day we will start tending towards it and finally we will end up being that.
In fact, this particular thing is going to probably feature in the conversation we're going to read out today, where Swami speaks about that idea of having being convinced about something even when you've not experienced it and how that works. I think later it comes, but even as you were telling about that that Chinnakatha, the other one which Swami would say, it again reiterates another point, because you know, even as you're saying, I was just playing the devil's advocate in my own mind and saying that, oh, does that mean that I can pretend to be a sannyasi and I can pretend to be a Swamiji and that's going to work in my favor? Because that's a question that people might ask. So I should start pretending to be a sannyasi, or everybody in this world, and we have plenty of them doing that, pretending to be saints and sannyasis wearing ochre. So you mean to say that that's a spiritual path in itself, is something that people might ask. But that's why, you know, Swami would often say that. The other Chinnakatha which Swami would say is about, you know, how some of the ministers in a king's court want to get even with him, and they get this artist from a drama and they tell him that you pretend to be a sannyasi, and you know, he says, but I don't have the language and the knowledge to go with that. They say, okay, you pretend to be one who has taken the oath of silence. You don't
Mauna Swami.
Right. And whoever comes in office, you don't accept anything. You just say, you know, you just wave it away. And they tell him that we'll take care of your food and your convenience and all that. Don't worry about that. But you just keep waving everything away. And I think they have this idea that they'll go and present this person in front of the king and, you know, get even with the king in some manner. And this person starts pretending that, and he sees that everything that he had craved for in his life through a successful career in dramatics was coming in front of him, and he was telling, I don't need it. You know, take it away.
He was waving his hand.
He's waving his hand away.
I don't want it.
Right. Everybody was coming and offering things, and he was like waving it away. And eventually the king comes to know, and the king comes, and the king is so moved by the detachment of this, you know, this person who he thinks is a sannyasi. And he in fact comes and offers a huge piece of land and a lot of wealth and all that, and this man keeps waving away. The king is so impressed that he says, I offer my kingdom to you. Make me your disciple. At that moment, the ministers are like, you know, this is the thing which we wanted. You know, we brought him down to the knees. And this man very casually waves it away. And it's then when the ministers come and ask him, what are you doing? You know, this is the point we wanted you to act till. And he says, no. See, I found that the genuine joy that I find in sacrifice, I have not found in pursuing these things. And the moment I am ready to sacrifice, even the greatest of wealth is coming to my feet, which means that is nothing, right? And Swami would say that is the genuine analysis of what you are going through, even when you're pretending, right? Yes, you're pretending, as you rightly said, the genuineness of that child it works in the child's favor because of that genuineness, right? Even though it is repeating something which has been told to it by its, you know, teacher or seniors, there's a genuineness in that, and that is what, even when this person is pretending to be a sannyasi, he's genuinely analyzing that experience which he's going through, and he's saying that the joy that I found of saying that I don't want this, you cannot bind me by this wealth. Mm-hmm. I didn't find this joy when I was going after the same wealth. And that experience actually matures that person. And probably I was just thinking of that, that that is what Swami will always say, Shraddha, you know, that genuine and earnest analysis learning of one's own thoughts and one's own experience is what is important. So what Swami is telling you in the form of the conversation is, yes, you know, we've heard Swami's discourses, we've heard others giving the right answers, and so we are saying it. But even as we're saying it, there will be an analysis which will, if not today, at some point start off if we are genuine in nature.
Going to the conversation, it where we left off last week, it actually continues between Hislop and the student, you know. Because Hislop asks, what is your career? What are you going to do in life? And the student says, I will do that which Swami tells me to do. Hislop then has no plans to do anything, no wish to do this kind of work or that kind of work. The student replies, when the correct plan comes, Swami will guide me into the work that is my correct duty in the world, just as he has guided these older boys standing there who have now taken up careers in the university. And Hislop then remarks, this is a strange idea to people in the world. The world over, young men arrive at their own decision as a career and then try to try for success in that career by applying their full energy. So it's very evident that Hislop is surprised by this answer, where students are saying that it all depends on Swami. And, you know, just reading this, it reminds me of the students whom we would term as waiting boys. If I'm not mistaken, Prem, you yourself was one waiting boy. Waiting boys is that category of students who complete their education and have no plans or goals to achieve anything by leaving the place or staying in the place. They wish to get further guidance from Swami. And they're called waiting boys because as they're waiting for Swami's instructions, Swami, for his own divine reasons, responds to some within a week, some within a month, some within years, and it goes on. So there have been people who have waited for few months, few years, few days, different time spans, but while waiting, it would be a life of sadhana, life centered around Swami. And I think it would be foolish on my part to speak about that when Prem is seated here. It will be really enlightening for our listeners and everyone, Prem, if you share the thoughts and feelings of these kind of students, you know, who would wait, just like the student is saying, that I don't have any wish or plan to do anything. I will just wait for Swami to tell me what I should do and do that.
I don't know with what context this is being said, but you know, if you look at it, it is only a reflection of what we generally refer to as surrender, you know, in a limited manner. And if you look at it, many people who come from the West or who come from this kind of an approach of where you take control over your life, they really cannot understand this idea of giving up a decision making. Here we're talking about giving up decision making to Swami. Even the idea of, in a traditional Indian family, you don't decide what career you take. I mean, now it has changed. I'm telling that probably a couple of generations before, the decision of whom you marry, what, you know, course you take, and whether you'll become an engineer or doctor, it was completely the family's prerogative to make that decision. And even now when we look back, we would say that, you know, how did you let your father decide what you would do? Right? So the idea of giving up a certain control of our life itself is very, very, unnatural to most of us in the modern context, that where we kind of take full control of whatever we do with life. But when you're talking about Swami, it's not only about decision making. It's not only about saying that, you know, I will do whatever Swami tells me to do. One part of it is that wisdom that Swami knows better than me. Mm-hmm. The other part of it is that ability to say that, you know, if Swami is telling me what to do is a command, Swami not telling me what to do is also a command, right? And that is not specific only to waiting boys. It's specific to any devotee, right? Because we generally get restless when Swami doesn't say The trick is to think that when Swami is not telling, that is the command at that moment. His silence is the command for that moment. We always think that the command is the command, right? Mm-hmm. And if you see, that is the relationship which, the maturity which happens with a devotee and anybody. Because as Swami would say, everybody comes here for receiving something. And invariably, it would be some form of decision making. You know, what career should I choose and whom should my daughter get married to or where should I invest? Should I go for a work or should I go for a business? I always think of this, you know, if you just have to go to our Facebook page and they would have all of these people. I mean, people have different ways of making their prayers. Some of them leave comments on the Facebook page like they're making a prayer to Swami. Right? Mm. You also would have seen that on our
Facebook page. Huh?
And you would see a lot of those comments like that. Swami, please guide my child what to do. Swami, my exam is coming. You know, please guide me what career I should take up after that. Because invariably, we are scared when a decision has to be made and we are very happy to give it to Swami to make that decision. That is probably a level lower. And Swami would actually test this. You know, when you talk about waiting boys, Swami would actually send elders to find out why you are waiting like that.
Hmm.
Are you waiting because you are indecisive? That is not what Swami would want, right? So Swami would send elders who will come and ask us, you know, you are just trying to relegate your decision making to Swami because you're afraid to make a decision, because you don't want to take the responsibility of making a decision.
Mm.
Then we'll have to say that that's not the thing, sir. So that is why when you say that I want Swami to choose what I have to do, it is a state of readiness to do anything that he points out to do. So it calls for a mental preparation to say that, Swami, I'm ready to do this job. I'm ready to do that job. I'm ready to do no job. Right? That's why I said that even that Swami not giving a command should be taken as a command. So as devotees, if I'm saying that Swami, you know, you guide me. Because we're all in that phase. Swami, you speak to me. You inspire me from within. You talk to me. I know that Swami is within me and Swami is going to guide me. So if Swami is silent within me, that is also part of the journey. It's not that, okay, the Swami inside is quiet, so let me look for a Swami outside. Or let me look for another person who is connected to the Swami inside and let me get my instruction from that person.
I think that's a very, very valid, very important point that you're making, that we should take Swami's silence too as a command. Because when we trust His wisdom, then if we are not supposed to do something, also should be taken as a gift of His love. In this, it is in the same vein that Swami would say, you know, during Ugadi, which is a New Year festival for the Karnataka and Andhra Pradesh people, Swami would say that you have this Ugadi Pachadi. Ugadi Pachadi is a dish that is prepared with all the different tastes. You know, there's something spicy in it, something salty in it, something sweet in it, something bitter in it, something sour in it. And Swami would say that when that is offered to you as prasadam, that is a gift from God, you must just consume it without distorting or contorting your face, you know, because the taste will not be awesome. But that is the idea about the philosophy about what the philosophy of our life should be. Whatever comes to us in life, whether it's sweet or sour, bitter or spicy or salty, or whatever, I must accept it as God's prasadam, and therefore I should accept it with reverence and celebration. So whether it is sweet or sour, it is God's gift. I think that is the thing, whether it is whether I'm told to do something or I'm told to do nothing, as in the case of silence, I accept both as God's command. And
in fact, even as I was narrating this, I'm reminded of that other story. I'm sure we must have narrated it before. But maybe you should take the time and narrate that, of Swami promising one of the old students that he'll give him a child.
Yes.
You know, when restlessness boils up, how Swami says that, you know, that holding on to the silence.
Yeah, you know, actually, this is a very lengthy and detailed story, but I'll try to just stick to the highlights. It's one of the students who passed out from Swami's school. I think in the 1980s, he had passed out. His name is Harish. And in 1991, in the Darshan lines, his father was a Sevadal in charge. And he asked Swami, "Swami, my son needs to be married now. He has reached marriageable age. I want you only to decide whatever, you know, like whether he should get married, and yes, then who, everything." Swami tells him to sit down, and he continues giving Padnamaskar. And in that same line, there's one more gentleman who gets up and tells, Swami, my daughter has reached marriageable age. And that's how Harish got married, actually. And instantly Swami fixed up these two fathers and Harish got married. And, you know, within a couple of years of marriage, during a routine checkup at the general hospital in Bangalore itself, at our Sri Satsai General Hospital, Dr. Savitramma, I'm sure you know her. Right. Yeah, she was one of the founding
She was for so many years she was there, I think, as a superintendent of the General Hospital.
General Hospital, yeah.
Bangalore.
So she comes and tells Harish that, you know, your wife has a problem. She has got a highly shrunken and shriveled uterus. She will never be able to bear children. So please, you break this gently upon her. I have just told it to you because this is something that women will be very sensitive to. So you decide and do that. And he agreed. But what happened was, instead of telling his wife, he went and told only his parents. He said, you know, this is a problem. It's amazing that, you know, at this point in time, just imagine, it is Swami who has arranged the wedding. One of the first thoughts that can arise is, Swami, why you did this to me?
You've relegated the decision making to Swami and Swami has made this decision.
This guy, yeah. Right. You know, it sometimes feels like almost not marrying would have been a better decision. You know, because it's not like it was a love marriage wherein I wanted to be with this person all my life. It's nothing like that. Out of my way, I'm going and getting married and this is the situation. But they just... It is credit to their family and this boy Harish that they just said, no, it is Swami, we'll just leave it. In fact, Harish didn't even tell his wife. He didn't even tell his in-laws, nobody. 5-6 years later, you know, this is in India especially, traditionally this is what happens. Within 2-3 years of marriage, people are going on looking forward to when will the child come. So when 5-6 years have passed without the child, medical checkup was done and that is when the parents of the wife realize this problem was there, and so they come and tell Harish that, you know, our daughter has this problem, and Harish says, yes, I know about it. And they are shocked. They said, you knew about it and you didn't tell us. He says, what is the use of telling anybody? Because I think I have just saved you 4 years of sorrow. That's what he said. But then they were insisting that you must tell Swami. Because Harish by that time had graduated into a regular Seva Dal, and every year when Swami visited Vrindavan, Swami would give Padnamaskar to all these Seva Dal volunteers who were regularly doing Seva. Harish was in no mood to do that, ask Swami about this, but when they were seated for Padnamaskar, his brother-in-law, in Swami's presence, started prodding him, telling, Hari, ask Swami. And Swami looks at Harish and asks, what? He's very embarrassed. He said he was the only married man there. So he goes to Swami's ear. And before he could even whisper what was the problem, Swami says, I know, six years. Swami will give. These were Swami's words. And it's with that joy and thrill that he goes back and he told his wife that, you know, Swami has said he will give. This was in 1997, 6 years after the wedding. But then, Swami had said he will give, but 98, 99, 2000, nothing happened, you know. Harish said that every now and then when Swami was in Vrindavan, he would look at Harish and then say, yes, I remember, I have to give you a child, you know. First few times Swami did that, and he said after that, the way the news spread, within 2-3 years of that, others around Swami, whenever Swami would come near Harish, they would look at Swami and almost like plead on his behalf, Swami, please, you know, do something for this man. And this happened like this till 2003. When it came to 2003, his wife decided to adopt a child. She told him that, I think this is what Swami meant by gifting a child, so let's go and adopt a child. And he was open to that. So they went to the orphanage and picked up a child and they were very happy to adopt. But something told Harish that, let me tell Swami first before adopting the child. So that year when Swami had come to Vrindavan, it was a little difficult time because that was the year Swami also had his fall. And Swami, you know, reduced the amount he was walking, so the darshans were all reduced. But when finally it came to the time of the Pada Namaskar, Harish got up to ask Swami and Swami had an irritated look on his face. He told him, you just sit, you man of little faith. And he was wondering what happened. And once again, without him having to tell anything, Swami told him, tell your wife that if this Sai Baba tells something, it has to happen. Just wait. Okay, so this was the message given to a couple that have already waited 12 years for a child. So 2003, the adoption plans were cancelled. 2004, 2005, 2006, 2007, 2008. You know, when we look back in retrospect, 2008 was the last year Swami ever went to Vrindavan. At that time, of course, they didn't know. And Harish says that suddenly Swami looked at him and he said, "Hey, next year I will give you the child." So he felt that this was a step forward, because till now Swami had said, "I will give." Now Swami is giving a time frame. So 2009 was an year of great anticipation for the couple, and how they waited years, now they waited months. Jan, Feb, March, April, May, June, July, August, September, October, November, December, Christ was born, but nothing happened to them. So 2009 was over, and 2010 was the 85th year of Advent, and every samiti, every state organization planned grand celebrations for the event. As part of Karnataka organization, you know, they decided to hold Rudram chanting in 85 different homes. One of the homes selected was Harish's home. And in February of 2010, there was Rudram chanting scheduled at their home. And as this Rudram chanting was going on, 85 times they wanted to chant Rudram, 85 different homes they wanted to do this Rudram chanting. So as this Rudram chanting was going on, he noticed that his wife collapsed, you know. But luckily there was a doctor. And guess which doctor? Dr. Savitrama herself. She was there in the audience and she was there attending on his wife. So he felt, it's okay, let me participate in this sadhana and complete it and then find out what went wrong, because she's anyway in safe hands. She's in the hands of the superintendent of the general hospital. So once the Rudram chanting got over, Dr. Savitrama calls Harish and tells him that you should be very careful. You should not allow your wife to do hard work and this and that. And he was getting worried, where is she headed to? And then she says, it's because she is 2 months pregnant now. She is carrying for the last 2 months and you didn't realize it. And that is when the couple realized that 2 months before is December 2009. Exactly as Swami had said, next year, in the year 2009, the child had been given. Of course, the story goes on, because the child developed some complications. It was due to be delivered in the 6th or 7th month itself, which is very, very dangerous and problematic for the child. But once again, by Swami's grace, finally it so happened that completing 9 months and 10 days, the child was delivered, a happy, bonny, healthy, bonny boy who currently studies in Swami's school at Prashantinilayam. And this was his story. And I actually got to know the story because when I met this Harish, he's a very elderly person, and Harish sir, and I said, "Sairam sir, how come you are here?" He said, "I've come to admit my son." And I asked him, "Which course has he taken?" And he said, no, for first standard. And honestly, Prem, I thought this must be his third or fourth child then, because seeing his age, a first standard child must be. Then anyway, who am I to delve into those personal details? I just said, "Very blessed sir to get admission in Swami school." And he said, "Forget getting admission in Swami school, it's very blessed to get a child," he said. And then he narrated the story, and I was simply stunned with the amount of patience and perseverance he displayed. 18 years waited with faith, without criticizing God. And 18 years ago, the divine paradox, the beauty of the way divinity works, is that the same doctor who said that your wife can never conceive because she has a shrunken uterus was the doctor who gave the news to Harish that your wife is carrying.
Absolutely. You know, that is what it is. We always would say that, you know, if you have to make a payment to me of say a lakh rupees or something like that, the moment you write a check and give it to me, I am richer by 1 lakh. You know, that money might come to my account maybe a couple of weeks later or whenever I'm in cashing it. That's how they do even on these game shows, right? The moment they write a $1 million check, you're a millionaire, right?
Correct.
Right? Mm. And Swami would say that's the same thing. When I give a word, it's already done. And many times Swami would say this, you know, when devotees, after Swami has told, just like it happened in the case of Brother Harish, you when Swami gives a word, you remind Swami about that, Swami would get very upset. And one of the dialogues which Swami would often say is, "I am Satya Sai Baba. Whatever I say is Satyam." He would say that, you know, and that is so true. And whenever, be it the waiting that we were talking about, or the idea that I want Swami to do something for me or decide something for me, that process of waiting is a moment where you can work on your mind. Because the ability to silence the restlessness of the mind is one of the most important things on the spiritual path. And when you're waiting that, you know, that's why when we talk about this period of waiting, which Swami gave us all the opportunity to go through, we would never ask Swami on a daily basis about a job at all.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like you've told Swami, Swami knows we are here for that, and Swami will know when to say.
So what do you do in the whole day?
Right. Okay, that's a long story. We'll leave that. But the thing of, you know, and how Swami will give a job will also be like that. It'll be absolutely out of the blue.
Mm-hmm.
All of a sudden, one day Swami will come and say, here, and what would have appeared like many years of nothing happening, and you won't realize how fast it happened.
Got sorted. Evening,
You'll be like, everything is done. And that is the thing with Swami, and I mean, that's how everything works with Swami. Right? And what you gain in that process of waiting for Swami to do something for you, and this is for all devotees, is much, much more than what you get when Swami really gives.
Mm.
Right? And that is why when Swami says this here, this is the process of surrender, where you say that, Swami, it's not wrong to say that, Swami, this is what I want, this I don't want. In fact, there's another very beautiful incident which one of the students was narrating. The student happened to be a lecturer in a college, right? Mm. Swami had blessed, again, his marriage with a devotee's daughter, and everything was fixed. The younger brother of this particular boy had just completed his master's in business administration from Swami's college, and I think he was working in Vrindavan, or he was just serving in Vrindavan briefly before he went on for a career. And he was going on telling his parents, then I want to stay in Swami's institutions. I don't want to get married. I'll be here all the while.
Hmm.
Apparently what happened, they were in Swami's interview room, the boy's family and the girl's family, and Swami was helping them prepare the invitation card for the wedding.
Hmm.
And out of the blue, Swami said, put the name of your second son too there. And Swami told the name of a girl, of another devotee's daughter, and Swami said, she'll be the girl. We'll perform both marriages together. Okay, and the boy has no clue that this is happening. He's happily sitting in, you know, Vrindavan or wherever.
Oh, he's not even in the interview
room. Okay. And the mother says, Swami, he's not very keen on marriage and he's too young and he's not interested and all that. Swami said, I'll see all that. You put his name also. So imagine the invitation card has been printed and this boy has no clue.
That he's the name in the card.
And the way he gets to know is very, very interesting. This is narrated by some of the teachers who were there on that occasion. This person comes. The next day is the wedding. He has come for the wedding of his brother. So Swami calls the entire family inside the interview room. Swami asks for the invitation card. And Swami gives it to this boy. And Swami is watching his expression.
Oh, inviting him for his own wedding.
Okay. And he's going through, okay, so-and-so my brother's name and my to-be sister-in-law's name and everything is there. And then he finds his own name there. And Swami is constantly looking at his face to see his reaction. And you can imagine everybody is looking at his face. He very casually looks at it, folds it, and he gives it back to Swami. And Swami, like after a brief moment of silence, tell what?
Swami is disappointed.
Hey, tell what? He said, what, Swami? Nothing to say. I've put your name also. We're performing your wedding also tomorrow. He said, Swami, if that is what you've decided, that'll be the best thing for me.
Mm.
And Swami was so happy to hear that. Right? See, it's not that he didn't have a preference. He did have a preference, but always in the back of your mind, you know that it can always be overruled by this one person. Right? And that's what is surrender, and that's the going back to that conversation between students. And see, whether we really have that surrender or not, even when we were students, we used to always tell Swami, whatever you say. And Swami sometimes will say, good, I will tell you. Sometimes he'll say, I've seen these many people. I know that you have something in your mind.
Mm.
But when you say that, at some point, it will get into you saying that, this is my preference. And Swami's word is my preference. And that's what this whole conversation is about, I think.
And the conversation gets even more interesting as we go ahead. But for that, dear listeners, you'll have to get your taste of waiting a little bit, possibly. We'll take a quick little break and on the other side of the break, continue with this conversation.
Oh,
Welcome back, dear listeners. We will continue the conversation. Hislop is asking a student about his career plans and the student is giving responses. So when Hislop says that it's a strange idea for people in the world that young men don't make their own decision and they are, you know, surrendering the choice to Bhagwan, the student says they did not know about their career until some inner prompting told them. Until that time, they did not know. The same for yourself. Until Swami told you to be president of the American Psy organization, you did not know about that. This is, I think, pretty awesome for a student to tell like this in Swami's presence. Then Hislop says, that is for sure. I certainly had no such wish or idea prior to Swami saying so. But you are so sure that Swami is God. Many people come here and go away not believing that. Their circumstances and early influences have bent them another way. And so, they are not able to see Swami as you do. How about them? And the student responds, some trees grow up straight towards the sky. Some are bent and twisted by stormy weather. It does not really matter. Even the most twisted person will come to know Swami as God. Hislop is obviously impressed and he says, how can you say that? How will that happen? The student replies, it cannot do other than happen. Swami, as God, is a resident of each person's heart, and the irresistible strength of this fact cannot but eventually make itself known. This is amazing conviction. As we said earlier already, whether it is in the pretend stage or the tent stage or the end stage, it doesn't matter. This is definitely what we should look forward to, this kind of conviction and faith and self-confidence.
In fact, you know, you can quite imagine Swami's, the pride in Swami's eyes when this conversation must have been happening. Because if you see some of our old videos, you would have these Balvikas children giving a talk, or even when Swami's students give a talk. Honestly, let me be very, very frank about it. Sometimes it's all rhetoric, you know. Mm. The standard statements will be being made. And you will feel like, oh, it's the same thing. But if you see Swami's expression when those statements are made, it's totally different. Swami will be like shaking his head vigorously and saying, yes, yes, yes. You know, what you're saying is right. That's what it is. You know, as you're saying, whether this is out of conviction or this is out of understanding or this is out of intellectual grasping of what this person is speaking about it, it nevertheless is conviction. He's saying, I don't know how it'll happen. But it is bound to happen because this is what it is. Mm. If you say that Swami is God, then Swami is in every heart. And it is just a matter of time before everybody turns to Swami. It might not necessarily be in the manner that everyone is going to worship the Satya Sai form. I think that is the block in our head. Will the whole world come and worship Swami in this form? But Swami is, from Swami's point of view, Swami will say that, you know, there's that very beautiful incident of which Deepak Anand sir would often narrate.
Mm-hmm.
That I forgot. I think it was 7th of August or 6th of August when all of a sudden Swami came early for morning darshan and sent word for those four research scholars. And that time the MBA department had four research scholars and Swami would very often talk to them and call them and to the interview room. So Swami sent word to the hostel that he is calling for these research scholars. Those days no mobile phones, so by the time the landline was called and all of that, they came running, and by the time they came, Swami was already in the interview room. And Swami had left instruction that whenever these boys come, ask them to come inside. So when they went into the interview room, Swami was sitting on the chair and his eyes were closed. So they very quietly went and sat. But Swami, after about a few minutes, Swami opened his eyes. He saw whether all of them are there. And then again, he closed his eyes. And Swami was like lost for about 15, 20 or maybe even more than that. And then slowly Swami opened his eyes and Swami asked, what day is it today? And they said, Swami, it's a Monday or Tuesday or whatever that particular day was. Swami said, no, what date is it? And I think 7th of August. Of August. They said, Swami, 7th of August. So Swami again asked, what is the speciality of this date? So they were actually wondering whether it's an important event in Swami's life or anything like that, but they could not think of anything. And then Swami himself said that this is the day on which the atom bomb was dropped on Hiroshima. And then Swami went on to say, in the town of Osaka in Japan, there is a prayer meeting and a huge number of people have gathered there and they are making a prayer that such a catastrophe should not happen in the world anywhere henceforth.
Hmm.
And Swami said, I went to receive their prayers.
Wow.
Right? And I think they asked whether it was, you know, the Sai Center people doing the meditation or organized by the organization there or something. And Swami said, no, they're just devotees who have gathered to mark the event with a prayer and making this prayer. Swami said, I received it and I've blessed them. I've ensured that, you know, their prayer is answered. So Deepak Anand and the other seniors who were there used to tell that, you know, this is Swami. For him, there is no barrier of this person belongs to the Sai organization, so his prayer gets priority, or so-and-so is having a picture of mine or Shirdi Baba in his altar and praying, so that comes to me. Any prayer offered to any form, any deity reaches the same Swami. So,
absolutely.
Right? So when this student is saying that, I mean, Swami is in every heart, and what a beautiful analogy it is. There are some trees which go straight, and some trees have a long route to, you know, to the same sunlight. What a beautiful way of putting it, and I'm sure Swami must have been so happy with this answer.
I remember listening to a story, I couldn't find a reference to it on the internet, but it was very interesting. Somebody asked Swami Vivekananda whether, in spite of all his bad habits, in spite of the bad life he has led so far, does he still have hope for salvation? And Swami Vivekananda asks him, have you any time seen Ramakrishna Paramahamsa? And this man replies, I don't think so that I have had an audience with him. But yes, once, I think in my life in passing, I happened to just glance at him. Once I have seen him as a passing glance. And Swami Vivekananda says, you have seen him that much, right? Don't worry, your life is redeemed. You know, you have salvation assured in your life. What thrilled me was, I don't know about whether this man got salvation or not, or what is the power of Swami Ramakrishna Paramahamsa, but the conviction and faith that Swami Vivekananda had in his guru, it was so inspiring. And this is a story that I heard when I was in school. I remember thinking that this is the kind of faith I too must have in Swami. And again, I don't know whether it's in the pretend end or end stage, but whatever stage, that should be our conviction, firm conviction in Bhagwan. And that is what the student is expressing through his words. And as you rightly said, naturally Swami will be so proud of that. Hislop continues and he says, you know, in response to what statement the student made, that God is the resident of each person's heart, and the irresistible strength of this fact cannot but eventually make itself known, Hislop says, you are so sure about it, but you are just a boy, just starting to experience life. Suppose a fully grown, widely experienced man comes to you and says, I tell you that Swami is just a man, an extraordinarily intelligent and powerful man. What would you say? And the student replies, Swami has taught us not to rely on the experience of another person, but to trust in our own experience. My experience is that Swami is God, and your experience is not mine. So, this is something irrefutable, and even, you know, one of the scientists, greatest scientists of all time, who is quoted to be atheistic, though he made statements about God, you know, it is said that the theists often quote him as if he's a believer in God, but his statement should not be interpreted in that manner. They mean something else. I'm talking about Albert Einstein. And he had said that God does not play dice with the universe. And there's a lot of material on the internet which says that that statement doesn't show that he was a theist. He was actually atheistic and all that. But all said and done, it's that same Albert Einstein who said that when theory conflicts with experience, go with the experience. And that is what he did all his life, and that's why he could come up with the most amazing scientific revelations and discoveries. I will not go into those, but when theory clashes with experience, go with the experience. And the student here is saying, I don't care about what anybody elsewhere says. My experience is this. Nobody can take that away from me. And your experience is not my experience. You know, interestingly, you know, when I was also a kid, it is from my childhood that I have believed in Swami as my God. And today, when people ask me, why do you believe in Swami in God, or how is it that you got proved that Swami is God, I may possibly narrate a few incidents for them to, you know, thrill them and show the miraculous nature of Swami. But honestly speaking, I did not have any miracle or any amazing experience to believe in Swami as God. I answer them by asking a question back. How did you believe that Ganesha is God? Or Hanuman is God? Or Shiva is God? Rama is God? Jesus is God? I mean, from childhood you are just told that they are God and you have accepted it. And your faith possibly has given you experiences later on to show that that is true. But you are not having any problem accepting a monkey-faced God, an elephant-faced God, a God who could not, you know, save himself from being crucified. You are ready to accept all of them as God. In the same way, I accepted Swami as God. You know, in my altar, there were all the gods. Swami was the one among them. And I accepted Swami as God. So, when it comes to the question of conviction, it has got a lot to do with faith and how that faith leads to experience. But of course, it leads to another question whether the faith comes first or the experience comes first. Because it feels like if there is an experience, naturally faith will get developed. But that question in a short time from now will actually be emerging in this conversation, and Swami gives a straight and point blank answer for that, so we'll not go into that now.
In fact, if you just look at this question which Hislop is asking, what if an intelligent man comes, you're a small boy, how are you so sure? It's typically the conversation that happens between Prahlada and Hiranyakashipu, right? Because when Swami describes Hiranyakashipu, he always talks of him as an intelligent scientist. Right, Hiranyakashipu and Hiranyaksha are supposed to be scientists of greatest order, and Swami would say they've gone to the Surya Loka and all of that. So their intelligence is challenged by Prahlada, who's purely going by experience, right? Because he says that, you know, I've experienced the joy of worshipping God, and I believe God is there, and that entire episode is that only. That Hiranyakashipu tries to brainwash him out of that, but the boy stands by his conviction. It's typically like that. What'll you do if an intelligent person comes and tells you? So
Supreme, from now on, this H instead of Hislop should be read as Hiranyakashipu.
Right, and talking of it from Hislop's point of view, I'm sure he is really thrilled by whatever he's seeing here, because going back to what Hislop has gone through before he has landed up in Swami's presence, right? He's really a person who has, you know, whatever we described about being genuinely analyzing your experience and going by the truth of that experience, that's precisely what Hislop has done. In one of the first episodes, we spoke about how he, gave up some of the organizations he was part of because he was feeling that genuine joy was not there. Somebody who was ready to give up something which that held so dearly, saying that, no, there's something wrong with this and I'm not being guided by this. So he must be really thrilled by these answers, because in a way they are also reaffirmations of what he has himself gone through. That when Swami is letting the student say this, you know, he's saying that experience is more important and your experience is more important than somebody else's experience, however genuine the other one might be. He must be feeling really thrilled that this is Swami's confirmation that what he has gone through and what he has done probably is the right thing.
Vindicating his own stand in life. Hislop, however, continues, whether in admiration or interest, we don't know about that, but he continues to ask a question. When you go out in the world, very likely you will get married. How will you relate to your wife? And the student says, Swami will have given me my wife. Swami is my spiritual father and mother. And in the real sense, I am born of him. He is God. And my wife is not different from him. He is in her heart. He is in her heart also. So I will regard my wife as mother, sister and God. And Hislop says, well, I have heard that mother and father are to be regarded as God. But this is the first time I have heard that one's wife is to be regarded as God. I believe we are going to face some problems in this matter.
Right.
And at this time, Swami tells Hislop to ask him what he will do if his wife says he cannot come to Puttaparthi. Now, yeah. Swami is adding masala into the mix.
This is typically of Swami. You know, so many times you would see that conversations with students in the portico. Swami will tell the VIP, you ask this. Even when you were telling about Swami asking this primary school child, you know, where do you come from? And he's saying that from thy lotus feet. In fact, they won't even say that from Swami's lotus feet. They will say from thy lotus feet. And one of the hilarious episodes that happened was when Swami had gone to the primary school with I think one of the visiting VIPs was a minister or something. So Swami was going into random classes and typically the same question, where do you come from and all of that. So Swami looked at one particular boy and Swami looked at this VIP and said, you ask him, where does he come from? Right. And this VIP asked, boy, where are you from? And he said, from thy lotus feet. Right. So many times Swami would do that. You ask, or you ask this, or instead of Swami directly asking, and that's precisely what Swami is doing here. Swami is, I'm sure the student whom Hislop is conversing with may probably not know Telugu. So Swami is telling in Telugu to a student to convey to Hislop to ask him this question. I think that's what's happening here. He's saying to Hislop in Telugu via another student. And
ask him what he will do if his wife says he cannot come,
he cannot come to Puttaparthi. And then Hislop takes the cue and says, you know, sometimes a wife develops a very strong personality and takes command of the family. Suppose such a wife says to you, you must not go to Puttaparthi. And then the student replies, well, I would not mind. You must know that a diamond has several facets. The largest face with the most reflective power represents God. But each smaller facet is the same diamond. My wife, who represents a smaller facet of the diamond, is also God. And my home is Puttaparthi. So I would be content with my Puttaparthi, with God in command. So that is what he says, but it's an interesting, I really would be keen to know what was Swami's response to this.
No, Hislop says, you say God is the diamond and that the brilliance of the largest facet represents him. Suppose Swami says come to Puttaparthi and your wife says do not go. Then the student says, it is God that I obey, not the wife as such. I would go to Puttaparthi. So, in this whole conversation, I think there are two things that stand out. One is this concept of surrender. Surrender wherein you accept everything as good for you and therefore you celebrate whatever happens in life. That's why when Hislop tells the student that what if your wife tells don't go to Puttaparthi, the student says that I will accept that as Swami's will. I will take this as Swami's will expressing through my wife. I will consider that as Swami and my home itself as Prashanthi Nilayam. And that is when Hislop adds the next complication, saying that what if Swami tells you to come to Puttaparthi and your wife says no? And the boy says that it's very clear. I will just leave my wife and I will come to Puttaparthi. It takes us back to the same conversation. Maybe last week we discussed it. Wherein Swami says that as far as you're concerned, Matru Deva Bhava, Pitru Deva Bhava, mother is God, father is God, parents are the first God. And parents come even before the Guru, even before God. However, Swami adds that for those who are inclined spiritually, whose interest in life is only spiritual, who wish to attain only spiritual progress, for them, nothing else matters more than God. While obeying God, you are allowed to disobey even your parents, your guru, anybody. And we had discussed how Swami gives examples of Prahallada disobeying the father, Bharata disobeying the mother, Vibhishana disobeying the brother. So many such instances. And that is also seen here again, because father is God, mother is God, even wife is God. But if they conflict what is being told by the representation of God, which is Swami, then obviously I am going to listen to what Swami has said.
And Swami would say that, you know, Swami would give this example in his discourses. He would say, Saint Tukaram, he had a wife who troubled him a lot, in the sense of she used to be very upset with his, you know, devotional singing and all the time being in satsangs and all that. And she used to get really angry, and the stories of how she beat him up once when he did not bring back enough food home and all of that. And Swami would contrast that with the wife of Sant Kabir. And he had a very, very pious wife who would not speak against whatever he says. And Swami would narrate that analogy of once Kabir asking for a lamp when it's broad daylight. He would say, I'm not able to see. I mean, I dropped the needle, I'm not able to find it, you get a lamp. And even though it's midday and it's absolutely bright, the wife does not question. She brings a lamp. And when she brings the lamp, Kabir shouts at her. He said, are you a fool? Why do I need a lamp in broad daylight? And she says, sorry, and she takes it back. And then there is apparently a doha which Kabir writes, that, you know, such a virtuous wife I have, who does not even question my something which is so obviously arrogant on my part or something like that is there. Swami would say that one had a wife who was completely against him and one had a wife which was completely in support of whatever he was doing. both were able to attain God. So it only means that your conviction is what is important. And clearly, as you know, this particular conversation, I have definitely not come across this with the boy students having this conversation. But apparently, whenever this kind of a conversation has come up in the context of the Anantapur girls talking to Swami, Swami would often say this. Let's say you might get married to a family which has no devotion to Swami and who are probably even not fond of the idea of coming to Puttaparthi and all that. Swami would say, it's all right. You do whatever work you're doing for the family as your worship. I will come to wherever you are. You don't even have to worry about, you know, oh, what will happen if my husband doesn't allow me to come. Because typically Swami has personally said that, and some of those old Anantapur students have some very, very beautiful stories to narrate. How through their perseverance and this one teaching which Swami has given them, they have managed to turn around the entire family to Swami eventually, just because of their virtuous living.
On that note, dear listeners, we will take another quick little break, on the other side of which we will continue this interesting conversation.
Welcome back, dear listeners. We were in that part where Swami was hinting questions to Hislop and asking Hislop to ask those questions to Swami's students. So that conversation is continuing. And Swami is saying, ask the boys some questions. The college boys were outside in the compound circled around Swami. And so Hislop turns to one of the students and says, what do you want? The student replies, I want Swami. I mean, after you graduate and go out into life, Hislop says. The student replies, I want Swami. Hislop again persists, who is Swami? The student says, he is love, he is God. Then Hislop asks, where is Swami? The student then replies, he is in my heart. Then Hislop continues, then Swami is in your heart and you already have Swami. What do you want to do in life? Doctor, lawyer, prime minister? Mm-hmm. The student replies, I will do as Swami tells me to do.
So it's almost like Hislop is bundled into, you know, Swami, Swami, everything Swami kind of reply. So Hislop now takes another interesting line of debating. He says, who is Hislop? The student says, he is Swami. Then why don't you say that I want Hislop? Student says, Hislop is a small portion of Swami, whereas Swami is God in full. At this point, Swami laughingly says, Hislop is a big, tall man, whereas Swami is a small one, only 5 feet tall. Hislop continues, how do you know that Swami is God? I see he is God. But you see only Swami's body. How do you see him as God? The student says, we have confidence that he is God. Where is God? God is everywhere. When you look at that tree, what do you see? The student says, I see God. How does this faith arise that God is everywhere? And the student says, there is some small experience of Swami, then there is faith. And it's here that actually Swami enters in to say whether faith comes first or experience comes first. But I think that we'll have to leave for next week's discussion, because it's almost 1:15 our studios. So we'll stop at this point and just go back to this little conversation that took place. You know, when the student is saying that I don't see a tree there and I see Swami, I see God in everything that I see around. This is fantastic. This is actually the ultimate objective in life. But personally, I would like to say with a disclaimer that many times we are able to feel that spiritual, what we think as spiritual joy, when things are all going fine, when things are all going happy. You know, the first stroke of misfortune, the same person who said that I see Swami in the tree, I see Swami in this, everywhere I see Swami's glory, I see Swami in the sky, the stars, the sun, the rising moon. The same person will tell, oh Swami, where are you? Why have you forsaken me? So therefore, as Kabir Das would say, dukh mein, it is the times of difficulty that you start remembering God and asking, where are you God, come and help me. In other times you barely remember God as such, because It's easy to cover up your neglect of God as, why do I need to do anything specifically for God? Why should I do bhajans? Why should I do puja? God is everywhere. God is in the sun, in the moon and all that. Therefore, it is these tough times that actually test how deep our conviction is, how true our conviction is. So, as I said, I'm not in any way casting any aspersion or doubt on what the student is speaking, whether he's having the conviction or not. But practically what I've seen in life is when things are going fine, you know, when you have health all around, when you have wealth all around, when all your relationships, everything, basic problems that humans face in life, if all these are going on fine, you tend to, you know, be spiritual, you tend to give these dialogues of having the ability to see Swami everywhere in everything. And naturally so, because when everything is going on so divinely well, it is easy to see Swami in everything. Just like you said, when Swami is coming and giving you instruction on a day-to-day basis, today you do this, today you do that, it's easy to say, I will do as Swami says, because Swami is speaking every day to me. But when Swami becomes silent, it requires a lot of courage, conviction and faith, and kshama, as Swami would say, fortitude, forbearance, to be able to take that silence also as a message from Swami. And therefore, when things are not going right, you know, when suddenly you are facing financial losses, or when you are seeing relationship disintegrate, or when you are seeing your health go down rapidly, at that time to take that as a gift from God and to see Swami in disease, see Swami in financial downfall, see Swami in a relationship going bad, that I think is true spirituality, and that is something we have to keep in mind. That's why I thought I'll lay it out as a disclaimer. We can judge how deep or how profound our philosophy and spirituality is when things are not going that fine, rather than when things are going fine.
Absolutely. In fact, there are two things which I'm seeing this. One is, of course, the part that we've kept away from for later, because when this student says that there is a small experience, so I know Swami is God, Swami immediately interrupts and says, no, faith comes first and then experience. We'll not go into that explanation because it's very, very good and we need some time to go into that. But one thing which is obvious is, till now, Swami was letting them speak. But once there was some inaccuracy in what they were saying, Swami is not hesitating to stop them and saying that, no, that is wrong. Right? Mm. It is not simply Swami standing there and saying that, okay, whatever you're saying is right. So which means Swami was agreeing with whatever was being told, at least to an extent.
Mm.
Whether it was coming out of experience or coming out of knowledge, it was what was being said was consistent with Swami's stance in some of these things. If you look at it, there was one conversation I was having with one of the teachers from Swami's institute. And, he had made this point during the teacher's, the workshop which they had before the academic year commenced.
Mm.
That's a time when all of these teachers come together and they kind of reflect what is the message that Swami has given over the years to Swami's teachers in the university and school. So one of the points which was made in that workshop was a very, very important one. In one of the interviews that Swami's university teachers had with Swami, they asked this question. That, Swami, there are a lot of things that we have to tell the students, but we ourselves are not following them. Right? Mm. We ourselves are not intellectually or spontaneously just following them. If you look at this, especially if you're a student and if you're a teacher in Swami's college, you have to be telling all of these philosophical things which probably you've never followed or you're not following. Right.
Mm.
So they ask this question. So what do we do, Swami? What do we do when we are in a situation where we know that unity of thought, word, and deed is a very important quality for Swami? So Swami said something which was very important. Swami said that it is all right. Even if you're not following it yourself, you say it. Because right now, you're in the role of a teacher. So as a teacher, it is also important for you to say the right thing. Just because you're not following it, it is wrong to tell them what is not right. Right?
Mm.
Your role is to tell the right thing, so you continue to say it. See, when we say something which we are not following, automatically that discord of thought, word, and deed is there. What most of us say is, oh, I am not doing what I am saying, so I will stop saying. What Swami is saying is, say it, and because you've said it, let the equilibrium be in the direction of you also trying to do what you have said.
Mm.
Right? Swami doesn't say it is okay to have discord of thought, word, and deed, but you strive for unity of thought, word, and deed in the direction of action rather than in the direction of withdrawing
even the words.
The words also, and saying that, okay, I've not done, so I'm not saying also. Right? So that is one thing which is very, very obvious. And the other point that you made about sorrow, there are two things about the wisdom vanishing or drying up in the moments of sorrow, right? Sorrow is one of the most beautiful ways to actually look at yourself and see your progress. I think if you look at even the Bhagavad Gita, that is where Arjuna's stance actually comes up. When he is sorrowful, Krishna says, okay, this is where you stand.
Mm.
The moment something like this happens and you're sorrowful, or something goes wrong in your life and you're sorrowful, which means that is your actual state and the progress that you're trying to make. It is not to feel bad that, oh God, I've lost everything. And once you have that sorrow, spontaneously not having any sorrow is the ultimate. Where you know that, you're not the body and nothing can happen to the body, or when you say that everything is Swami and whatever happens is Swami. When you have that thought which is absolutely drilled into your head, spontaneously there'll be no sorrow. But till that point, I think all of us in the state where if anything disastrous happens to us, we're going to be bogged down by that sorrow. But how are you going to come out of that sorrow? You can always remind yourself of these truths and then come out of that sorrow. Generally, we don't do that. You know, if you come and do something which is hurting me, the way I'm trying to assuage my sorrow is by getting even with you, by taking revenge or doing something which will, you know, give me that kind of a sadistic pleasure. But the other way of dealing with that sorrow is with the truth, saying that, no, if this has happened, this must be good for me. Whatever Swami does for me is good for me. So you're not in that state where you don't have sorrow, but you have at least equipped with the right kind of things with which you should deal with that sorrow. So I think that is one of the reasons why Swami is allowing the students to speak even something which probably is not part of their experience. Because when disaster strikes, they will be put in their place. I mean, all of us, we are put in our place when disaster strikes. But how we get out of that disaster, we will be using all of these tools which we so eloquently spoke when everything was hunky-dory and everything was rosy.
See, it's time to conclude, but I just want to add one more thought, amplifying the same thing that you said about when Swami told the teachers that even if you're not following, it's your duty to speak, so you speak it out. You know, when we go in these flights, you have the attendant standing there and telling you what to do in case of an emergency crash landing, in case of a landing in water, and in case the cabin pressure drops. I don't think everyone have been through that experience. I don't think they know what to do with the flotation device. I don't know if they actually have done it. But still, it's their duty and they're supposed to do it. And it's not only about giving information to the passengers, it's also about giving confidence to the passengers that, hey, in case something happens, these guys will be able to take care of it. Even though they have never done it. You know, so it's not just about passing on the information to the students. It's also giving confidence to the student that, hey, you know, if I follow this in life, my life will be comfortable and I will not have any crash landings. So in that sense, it is important whether they practice it or not to speak it because it's their duty. And as you put it, in to tend towards the equilibrium of starting to practice more because I'm speaking it, rather than giving up speaking because I'm not practicing it. So dear listeners, this should be a message for all of us as well. Let us not give up speaking about Swami's teachings or speaking about Swami's glory, feeling guilty that we are not practicing whatever we speak. Instead, let us go the other way. Let us think that because we are speaking so much about it, let us try to put something of it at least into our practice in our daily lives. I'm sure it's going to benefit us the most more than anybody else. On that note, dear listeners, we will bring this satsang to a close. We hope you enjoyed it. As always, you can write to us at listener@radiosai.org.
Or now you can even send us your feedback on WhatsApp. The number is 9393258258. So you can text us or you can even record your comment and you can send it to us. So that's our feedback number for sending us through WhatsApp. So with that, dear listeners, we're going to leave you with a song. On the other side of it, you'll be joined by Brother Chandu for his segment, Love to Love. We'll meet you again next week at 12:30 p.m. on another episode of Afternoon Satsang.
Shri Satya Sai Naam Pavan Ati Madhura Paladayakam Shanti Tata Vibhuti Tata Isha Tribhuvana Nayakam Shanti Tata Vibhuti Tata Isha Tribhuvana Satya Sai Naam Pavan Ati Madhura Paradayakam Srishti Karta Jeeva Bharta Adi Deva Maheshwaram Srishti Karta Jeeva Bharta Maheshwaram Bhaktaranjan Yogeshwaram Bhaktaranjana Adama Bhanjana Premamaya Parameshwaram Shri Satya Sai Naam Pavana Ati Madhura Paradayakam Nayana Karuna Supurita Vachana Amrita Dharanam Nayana Karuna Jala Supurita Vachana Amrita Dharanam Murti Satyam Shivam Yevam Sundaram Bhavakaranam Murti Satyam Shivam Yevam Sundaram Bhavakaranam Shri Satya Sai Naam Pavan Ati Madhura Paradayakam Pahi Pahi Dayalu Sai Nath Prabhu Dharani Sakala Bhava Badharam Bhaktika Varadhan Dije Sakala Bhava Badharam Shri Satya Sai Naam Pavan Ati Madhura Paladayakam Shanti Data Vibhuti Shatribhuvananayakam Shri Satya Sai Naam Pavan Ati Madhura Paradayakam Ati Madhura Paradayakam